Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm your host, Sam Sapp, owner of LockBod. I'm joined today with Bill Green, founder of Affect Advisors, a chief consultant for businesses. Did I kind of get that right? You said, what was it again? You said you like to create a company culture where it creates a killer vibe. I think I got that in a quick summary.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate, Sam. I like to say that I help busy leaders translate strategy and culture to create a killer company vibe that people love, their customers and their employees. Great place to work, great place to do business.
I love that. I love that. That's fantastic. It all starts
Thank
at the
you.
top, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Starts with the leader, everyone, each individual. It's got to be sound with who they are and what they believe in. And then ultimately, if it's right and good and there's some vulnerability and trust, then people tend to want to follow. Then you get a good company vibe.
So I want to create kind of a quick side tangent to our typical podcast programming, if you will, because I feel like how you and I started this recording in general is just like a perfect entrepreneurial sort of business blip that a lot of people maybe don't get visibility on sometimes. You and I met over a mutual acquaintance and friend, and then we get into a recording, we get into just a Zoom meeting, and I happen to have an opening. And you're like, sure, let's do it.
Yeah.
I feel like that stuff, and you said that stuff isn't all that uncommon for you even.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. I'm a big fan of the hero's journey, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey as a general construct for life. You know, and I think the call to adventure is something that I've always been inspired by. I didn't really know what it was until the first time I was exposed to that Joseph Campbell work. But, you know, Donald Miller and StoryBrand kind of made it famous. But, you know, I've learned as I've kind of become an entrepreneur over the last decade or so, and certainly as I've gotten into my 50s and sent my kids off into their next journeys, that there's really something powerful in that call to adventure and really being free to kind of do what makes you feel good, as long as it's right and in line with your values. You know, take a chance, do the thing, you know? And so when an opportunity comes to sit and chat with someone like you about things that I believe in, I'm not passing it up.
I love it. That's fantastic. So let's talk about then what kind of started. So here's how I like to rewind the hero's journey. Let's go kind of back to that high school period where, you know, maybe you're about ready to kind of go off into college and people are telling you, you know, hey, what are you going to go to college for? Who are you going to be when you grow up? And what's kind of that first dream that's evolving in your mind?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's probably important to start by the fact that even though it's hard for me to admit that at 55, I'm part of a generation that I used to think was old. I don't feel old, but there was a time when 55 seemed like 85. And, you know, I'm a older Xer, maybe 5 years shy of boomer. So, you know, in my high school years, the idea that, especially from where I came from, you know, very, very, you know, I'd say lower middle class family in a small Detroit suburb with a lot of auto workers and kind of blue collar union guys and stuff. You know, the idea that you'd even go to college was kind of unusual, but that you'd kind of aspire to do anything amazing where I came from was sort of like not even on the radar. It was really just about, you know, do your best, work hard, get a good job, don't complain, work as hard as you can for as long as you can, save your money and retire and like go on some vacations. And though I never really thought of it that way at 17, 18 years old, that's kind of the paradigm that I had. So it was a long, long time before I began to see the opportunity to sort of like flourish and go beyond the pale, you know? But I think at the time, you know, it was just like, I got a scholarship to go to college, a small Division II school in Detroit. And most people don't know where Wayne State University is, but I was able to go to college for free because of academics. And so I kind of went there somewhat begrudgingly. Like I didn't really want to go there. All my friends were going to Michigan State or Michigan or wherever. And I'm going to Wayne State and commuting, but I ended up, believe it or not, kind of against what I sort of thought would happen. I joined a fraternity at a school where there really wasn't a big Greek influence. It was a commuter school. And I just happened to meet some really amazing people, you know, people that went on to become surgeons and lawyers and judges and successful business owners. Now, at that time, I had no idea what these people were going to be like, but they impressed me and it made me stay at Wayne State. I didn't transfer like I thought I might. It made me join something I didn't think I would do. I never really considered myself much of a joiner at that point, but I learned a ton and was exposed to things in college that really shaped me to become the man that I am today and teach me a lot about myself and kind of put me on the journey, I think, to that idea that you've got to be really confident in who you are and develop yourself and always be looking to grow and serve and do all the things that are now important to me. But I guess at that time, I thought I was just meeting some good friends and having some fun in college and doing something the college kids do. And lo and behold, I'm still very involved as an alumnus and a volunteer to this very day. And that experience really kind of shaped me and changed a lot of the ways that I look at life. So at an early age, I thought, if I go to college and get a good job, I'm doing a good thing. But I think that experience really opened my eyes to the idea of possibility and who I could become and what I was capable of. And then as I kind of went on in my life, I really, as I said earlier, just kind of look for ways to respond to the call to adventure whenever I can. So in some ways, if you go to the Joseph Campbell construct, it's sort of that ordinary world. I was living in an ordinary world that was, to me, just, there was no such thing as extraordinary. You just do your thing, you know? And I'm grateful for that experience because it's changed my life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I love that you bring that up. I made it pretty far before, there was a company I worked and it was an interesting thing. We were kind of a 24/7 shop, but we were small. It was a small agency. And so the theoretical trick was for the later shifts, we were going to hire creatives.
Mm-hmm.
So that way they kind of had something to do while they were watching for basically a red light to blink. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, and one of them introduced me to the hero's journey. And, it's just at a high level, the idea, it does seem very relevant, doesn't it? Someone or something comes along and says, "Hey, how about this?" Right?
Yeah.
And we kind of naively maybe jump into it or are pulled into it in some cases, only to realize later the depth involved in
taking that kind of like crossing the chasm, taking that leap of faith into the adventure, which on the other side is the extraordinary world, is something that a lot of people unfortunately never experience for one reason or the other. And like you said, I think sometimes you need to be called, you need to be pulled, pushed, shoved, or otherwise coerced into it. But other times I think you enter it willingly with, great energy and passion. And, I do feel that there's too many people that don't understand what it's like to be called to adventure and to respond to that call and take it on with that sense of vigor and freedom that it brings. And I think that's the part that I've really come to appreciate, particularly in the last, I'd say 3 to 5 years of my life, but certainly in the time since I've become an entrepreneur. But, there's otherwise, I think in my experience, it's been more of a sense of obligation and duty and responsibility than adventure and freedom. And I don't think those are mutually exclusive. I think you can have all of it, responsibility and purpose and, things like that, but also adventure and freedom. It's just, how do you prioritize it and put yourself in a position to kind of know what you want, how you need to show up to get it, and then do the things that it takes to get there. That's the challenge.
So kind of tell me about what was the first big role out of college that offered that hero's journey that pulled you into the unknown?
Yeah. So I'd always thought I wanted to be a doctor. I loved children and kids, babysat, summer camps, coached kids as a high schooler. So I just loved helping kids and being around them and helping them grow and develop and things. So I decided I wanted to be a pediatrician. Then I kind of realized going into college that I was going to have to go to school for a dozen years or more. And I'm like, I'm not so sure I'm into that for a variety of reasons. So I kind of wound up getting into healthcare communications, public relations, marketing, and things like that. So my first kind of big job out of college was in public relations for a health system, small regional health system in the Detroit area. And I think the first real recognition that it was a call to adventure was it was a small, kind of like you were just describing your own circumstance, a small shop, three people in it. And I had to kind of wear a lot of hats, from writing the company newsletter to writing press releases, organizing community events, writing speeches for the CEO. Then it kind of, as I got more effective at delivering on my talent and education, I got more responsibility. So I was doing live interviews on television with the local news media, et cetera. And even at one point I was on CNN, so it was kind of a big deal at 23 years old or 24 years old to be taking on all these responsibilities in my world. So it was really kind of cool. And again, I think the humble beginnings, I guess, or the you could argue the sort of blinders that I had on at that point in my life. I didn't even know what I didn't know or what I was getting myself into. But looking back on it now, and even at that time a little bit, you know, thinking to myself, gosh, I'm getting all these really cool opportunities to do all this really cool stuff, not shoved over in a corner somewhere, like in a big health system or a big public relations firm where I'm doing the same two or three things every day, all day. I was really grateful for the 4 years I did that to be able to really run the gamut and learn a lot of things, baptism by fire, you know, be thrown to the wolves, all that kind of thing. And it really helped me grow. And I think, you know, paired with my college experience and some of the things I did while at Wayne State, that 4 year period of my life kind of raised it up in the professional level where you kind of reap what you sow. And the more challenge you take on, the more you respond to the call to adventure, the more you know, take a risk and believe in yourself and be vulnerable and try something you don't know, the more you get back. And it just sort of became this, maybe not intentional, but purposeful approach to life that just kind of like, I don't know if I grabbed onto it or it grabbed onto me or what, but it just became sort of the way that I've, you know, done things. You know, why not give it a shot? Give it a try. It's consistent with what I believe. Let's give it a try. Make it work.
I
So that
feel
was the
like,
first time I.
I feel like being on the news is almost like I wish because of the speed at which media operates. I mean, even just being on a local one for me, you know, like I think I described you a little bit. It's like they call you in the morning and you know, we need you on by like 1 p.m., right? In order to make the 5 p.m. news. And while all that sounds perfectly logical, for somebody that has like a full calendar that isn't expecting the call, and it's exactly that. It's the call to, and then, right, by the time the day's over, you're getting to watch yourself in almost like this sort of, I wish I knew how to describe it, the sort of like, oh yeah, that did happen today. Huh. That's crazy. So, interesting. Okay. Well, wow, that's fascinating. And then the other interesting thing too is seems like they can clip you up and get you to say almost whatever they want you to by the time
I experienced that
it's
once or
all
twice. I
done.
remember thinking, I said that because it's on the video, except what you didn't see was what you asked me before and what I said after. And when you pull that one piece out, and I learned a lot, obviously, baptism by fire. But, you know, be careful what you say because it could be cut up in a couple of ways. And I remember walking in to the office the next day, one particular time, and my boss was like, "Hey, can I talk to you for a minute, Bill?" And I'm like, "Uh-oh, I saw the same clip you did." And I'm like, "I need you to know that's not what I said." And she's like, "I know, I understand, but you got to be careful." And she was a great coach and a great leader, but yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I got burnt once or twice myself.
Well, it's 15 minutes, 15, what, 30 minutes? I mean, how long were your, because it sounds like yours was like a press release, essentially, or a press conference. How long were they typically, right?
Yeah, I mean, I had a couple of different times. I was interviewed once for a print paper where it was a longer
Okay.
interview and they pulled out quotes. The other time I was on a live, you know, live at five kind of thing. There had been an accident and some fatalities, and they pulled me in outside the ER to literally interview me live about it. So it was 5 minutes or so, 10 minute stops. And there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, there was no second take or anything. It was a live interview. And then a lot of other opportunities over my life in similar circumstances. But being quick on your feet, which I think kind of comes back to the idea that when you are kind of good with yourself and you know who you are and what you're about, even if you make mistakes, which you're going to do, you know, you live with them. You know, it is what it is. Worst thing that happens, I get fired, you know. But not saying something I don't really mean or trying to say something I don't really know how to say. I think, you know, though I didn't know it at the time, it was really the first of many tests to just being authentic and real and true and honest and vulnerable and just owning it. Because if it doesn't work out, it wasn't because I was trying to be a jerk or fail. It's because I said what I felt and it didn't come off right. But you learn, because I think at the end of the day, you just got to always be finding ways to challenge yourself to be better and to improve. And if you're not open to that, if you're not vulnerable and humble enough to sort of see the mistake you made, you probably make it again.
Well, I think, yeah, I think some people miss that. The fact that you are going to make mistakes, right? But then that also makes you better. And sometimes the mistakes will be in crazy situations, like on the TV, or I still remember this, probably even this blazer. I was in my one of my interviews early on, I'm wearing this blazer and I didn't unbutton and it just looked like the goofiest thing. And they still aired it just fine. And I'm looking at it
Yeah.
like, ah, and I even had a buddy of mine message me, like, he took a snapshot of it and he was like, "You're supposed to unbutton your blazer, goof." And I was like,
Yeah.
and honestly, I didn't even know that at the time. Believe it or not, just
Yeah.
transparently, I thought you could do it either way. But then you see
Yeah.
it on live and
Yeah.
you're like,
Yeah.
well,
Live
won't
and
make that
learn.
mistake again.
That's right. We learn more from our mistakes than we do from our successes most of the time.
We
That's for
do.
sure.
So what progressed you out of that? What pulled you out of that one?
That career or that situation?
That career.
Yeah. I had the opportunity from that point to, I was starting a family at the time, and we had bigger goals, and the income I was making at the time could pay for. So I had an opportunity to get into healthcare sales. Kind of stayed consistent with what I believed and what I like to do, which is to help people live healthier lives. The great company, and I spent 23 years there, sales and sales leadership, account management, but big healthcare sales, and it really gave me a good opportunity to kind of do the things I love to do, kind of work in that marketing, advertising, PR type communications field, but to do it in a way that gave it was more lucrative and also more flexibility in my life, more perks and benefits and things, healthcare and 401k and all the things that were important at that time in my life. I was in my mid-20s and family and stuff. So that was the impetus. But I was there for 23 years before I retired and devoted all my time to my business. But I'm super, super grateful for the experience. Learned a ton. And frankly, I mean, I think in the 23 years I did that, it was really the kind of precursor and the inspiration for the work I'm doing now, because I got to see what it looked like when the company vibe was good and when the company vibe wasn't so good, and the effect that I could have on it changing by doing things that I knew needed to be done to inspire people to want to show up authentically and help the business thrive. So, yeah, I mean, just opportunity is probably the headline. Good, a better opportunity came along, and it wasn't inconsistent with how I believed and what I wanted to do and how I wanted to deliver my talents, but it was a much more lucrative arrangement and gave me the opportunity to do things with my family that I wouldn't have otherwise been able to accomplish.
Tell me about how big was the company? You said you were there for 23 years.
23 years, yeah. It's a big pharma company. So, gosh, well over 10,000 people worldwide, probably even more. But just in my own region at the time, we'd had, at any given time across the different organizations, probably 1,000 people in my own region. So, but my team was 10 sales leaders and each had 12 representatives. So at any given time, I'd work on a team of 60 to 100 people, but as part of a much larger organization. So.
So tell me about big pharma sales, because that's not only an industry with a lot of legislation around it, that's
Yeah.
also an interesting industry with, I think a lot of people tend to look poorly upon big pharma, so to speak.
Yeah.
Whereas you're giving a perfect example of, like, I mean, you said follows my values. All I want to help do
Yeah.
is help people live
Yeah.
healthier lives, which I think
Yeah.
is the best version of sales anyway.
Yeah.
But then we have this, I don't know if you saw this Netflix special a year ago or that something
Yeah.
that came out, and it was all
Yeah.
about basically the opioid crisis. How
Yes.
some industries, and one in
Yes.
particular, I hope I'm not talking about the one you worked for,
No.
but they
No.
put it e either way, they put it in this
Yeah.
salacious light where some of these,
Yeah.
it seems like they were almost coercing doctors to prescribe more
Yeah.
opioids, and
Yeah.
that only fed into the problem. So kind of tell
Yeah.
me about what does that look like in your average big pharma that isn't
Yeah.
the dark side?
I would say, I worked for Merck. And one of the reasons I ended up choosing that job was because of the company's reputation, which, in my opinion, nobody's perfect, no company's perfect. But in the 23 years I was there, the thing that I appreciated the most about the company was they brought either first in class or best in class medicines, and they did everything with the most amazing integrity. Again, that's not to say that the prices couldn't have been lower, or, they could have made it easier for people to get. There's always, decisions made well above my pay grade that sometimes I don't agree with myself. But fundamentally, I never felt like I was put in a position to do anything that would make me compromise my ideals. And there are plenty of companies other than Merck that operate similarly. Unfortunately, the one you're referring to from the Netflix special at least according to, you know, the way it all worked out, they weren't operating with that level of integrity. So they were indeed trying to sort of tip the tables or cover up things or whatever, allegedly. I don't know the full details, but I never found myself in that position in my company. And so I think there's an element of not just the industry, but the company you choose. And I think that's true anywhere, your business or you know, anything, where if the organization and its leaders, you know, want to deliver the value in the way that they deliver value with the utmost integrity and confidence and trust and all that kind of stuff, then I think it's a lot easier to kind of navigate downturns or challenges. So I felt like in some ways I was insulated, I guess, maybe not immune, but insulated, because we were always bringing medicines to the market that really benefited people, either saved their lives, improved their lives. We made access as affordable as possible. And, you know, generally speaking, I think we enjoyed a reputation from providers and patients where, you know, Merck was viewed favorably, and we never got involved in anything like that. So I was never put in a position personally where I had to sort of behave in a way that was inconsistent with how I believe. And I really believe, at least the products that I ever dealt with, I always felt really good talking to doctors and providers and to the extent I had to patients about them, because I knew they were good and they were going to help improve asthma or osteoporosis or cholesterol or whatever, prevent disease. So it was kind of cool to be able to, you know, I go back to my point earlier, like I wanted to be a doctor because I love the idea of helping people. I always felt like what I was doing, while it was giving me a good living and helping my family grow and get what it wanted, I always felt like I was doing something at work every day that mattered. And the people that I worked with and for and who worked for me, you know, I wanted them to have that same vibe, that same energy, that they were doing good work and helping improve lives and save lives. I never felt like they had to compromise their own integrity to do it. And they could have, you know, have a good living doing so. So that was my experience. Now, I certainly know people who have had different ones where the pressure to sell was greater than someone's ability to do it, or decisions that were being made from on high were not consistent with, you know, the company values, let alone the values of the employees. So I just have never experienced that personally, but I'm familiar with the Netflix special you're talking about. And I've heard of other examples like that. I mean, we had our fair share of things that didn't go the way that we thought they would, but we always did the right thing, in my opinion, pulled the drug from the market, or, you know, changed the dose, or, you know, put a label on it that was with a warning or whatever the case may be. Not because we had to, although sometimes we did, but because we wanted to. We felt that was the right thing to do. So that helped me as a young person appreciate the importance of corporate integrity, I think. And, you know, as a business owner and entrepreneur now, it really made me appreciate and value how important it is to act in the best interest of the people you're serving, not just yourself, you know, because sometimes what's good for you is not for everyone else. And if it's not good for everyone else, then it shouldn't be good for you.
Right. Well, and I, this is an interesting topic, because it also hits on something that I feel like it sounds like the company did a good job of, because this is something I feel personally, like I see a lot of companies fail in, mm-hmm. that I think nonprofits, for example, tend to do better at. The nonprofits tend to do a better job at, like, you know, this is how we're helping our local community and those around us in this positive way. And you hear about people coming on at working at the nonprofit specifically because they were able to help their environment and their community. What I think is sometimes discounted is, you know, the example you're giving and how much you were able to help the community and help people with mm-hmm. the appropriate types of medications, right? That mm-hmm. are mm-hmm. going to make the biggest impact. And when it's found for some reason that they're not, the company is doing the right thing and pulling those. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. you as an individual could feel that you're, how do you think a company, and this is maybe a pretty decent segue, how do you think a company appropriately fosters down to the entry stage levels?
Yeah.
The fact that it's like, look, this is what we're doing to help those around us. I mean, yeah. Hopefully we're all getting paid for it. That's part of the value yeah. of a company. But on the same token, that doesn't mean we can't help people at the same time and maybe even put that before.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Sam. And, you know, I didn't know it then or didn't articulate it then, but what I've learned and assimilated into my business and everything that I do with my clients, you know, the very first thing I talk about whenever I start with a new client, whenever I work with an organization, no matter what size, is the importance of leading with values, and not just for feel good purposes, but creating core values that are real and authentic and in your fiber as an organization, that you would use them as a filter for every decision you make, financial or otherwise. If it doesn't meet the values test, it doesn't work. Flat, plain and simple. No, non-negotiable. And then the behaviors and the way that you demonstrate the habits you deliver each day. So it sounds trite and it can be very warm, fuzzy, and, you know, woo-woo. But I think leading with values is the answer. I mean, if you don't have core values that are real and that you can back up with your just very presence and the way you execute, then when you get faced with those challenges, no matter the industry, no matter the challenge, you're going to be kind of climbing uphill on roller skates because you're trying to get to something that is probably more financial focused, save the revenue, increase the profit, you know, don't get the bad press, whatever. Instead of saying, wait a minute, this doesn't comport with what we believe, so we're not going to do it. Because even when you make mistakes in a business, good or bad, you know, for you, if they're consistent with your values, you at least can sleep at night knowing that you live the way that you say you live. So if you're a company that says our value is to make money over people's safety, and you're clear about that as your value, I know this, it sounds absurd, but let's just, you know, hypothetically say, and therefore every decision you make is putting money over people's safety, people can't complain because you stated that's what you were intending. But what most organizations will do is, hey, well, we believe people's safety is the most important, even over profit. And then the first opportunity to save profit, they take the profit and they ditch the patient safety or person safety. That's inconsistent with the value. So if you say who you are and you live who you say you are, everything becomes easier, no matter what the condition. So I experienced that at Merck. I've experienced that in other aspects of my life. And I believe that with my whole heart, that if you're going to run a big business, a good business, no matter how big, it has to start by leading with values and not just words on a wall and catchy phrases that everyone else uses, but the ones that come from your core, your DNA as an organization. And often it starts with the leader, if it's a smaller company, you know. But so the short answer is, I think, you know, when you lead with your values, the challenges you face are a heck of a lot easier to face. Doesn't mean they're going to be easy, but they're easier.
Right. So kind of tell me about that progression then into consulting and helping to bring about those core values for companies.
Yeah. It's interesting the way that that kind of happened. I saw maybe midway through my 15 years or so of people leadership that there were a lot of times that what the company wanted for the brand or for the geography, for the business, was consistent with its values. And right and just and high integrity. So there's nothing wrong with what it wanted, but it wanted to sell more of its product. And it believed it could sell X, even though Y was what was being sold. So that gap was always needing to be filled. And part of my responsibility as a sales leader was to rally my team to fill that gap. And so there were too many times, maybe midway through my 15-year leadership career, towards the end of it, where I would run into two or three people out of 10 or 12 at any given period of time, you know, 6 months to a year, where I could tell that the way that the person was showing up to do the work and the results they were getting from the work that they were doing wasn't jiving. The vibe was off. And it wasn't so much that their core values and the company's core values were a mismatch. It was the competencies that it took to deliver that value for the company weren't there. And it became a struggle for the person to live their core values and deliver the company's expectations. And so it became evident to me as a leader that if people can't show up and be authentically who they are at work every day, whatever you're asking them to do is going to be less than expected. Because people need to be real when they go to work. And they have to be able to say, hey, Bill, I know you're my boss and my coach and my leader, and I want to deliver, but I just can't do that. Can you show me how? Can you ask me to do something else? Or can I leave and go do something that's more consistent with my capacity? And what I learned, Sam, was, you know, the more you could create an environment where people felt comfortable and vulnerable enough to tell you, I want to get better at this. I don't know how, but I'm willing to learn. I know I'm not good at this, and I don't ever really want to do it what it takes. So I'm going to either fake it till I make it, or I'm going to ask you to give me grace while I get out of here. human dignity and respecting the way people have to be when they go to work is the most important thing, no matter what you do. Period. Full stop. And so that was the moment I thought, you know what? I happen to work at a pharmaceutical company, and I happen to be responsible for moving market share for pharmaceutical products, but I'm really in the people development, human potential realization business. And that's what I love to do. So I said to myself, probably at 43, I'm 55 now. So however long it was, maybe, I don't know, 10 years into being a leader, that when I turned 50, I told myself, when I turned 50, I want to help organizations who have people coming to work every day feeling like that, not feel like that. So I want them to be clear in what's expected. I want them to be capable to deliver on it. I want them to be confident that they're being their authentic self. And I turned 50 and I went all in on doing what I'm doing now. With all
That's
kinds of
exciting.
Lessons from the trenches in my back pocket.
That's exciting. So doing what you're doing now. So you're 5 years into this then, formally?
Well, yeah, I'd say 5 years. The first 4 years or so, I was kind of doing it side hustle, on the side, in my free time. And the last 5 years have been full on, you know, committing to making this happen. Yeah.
That's exciting. Okay, so you made kind of the transitional leap, if you will. I mean, you
yes.
still leapt, but you did. That's exciting. Okay.
Yeah.
So, wow. So how's that been then?
It's been great. I mean, I think, you know, the first couple of years, I you know, my timing, as usual, wasn't the greatest. I decided to retire after my 50th birthday in 2019 and go in, all in on my business. I'd saved some money and put myself in a position to, you know, kind of have a year of living dangerously. And then COVID came. And so
nothing exciting happened in 2020.
No, in 2020, I was in a very kind of like, uh-oh, what do I do? So kind of the humbling part of it was I took on a fair number of consulting, kind of contractual, you know, opportunities in the healthcare space where I had some traction and some network to kind of do the things I was doing to kind of fill the gap and keep the cash flow coming while I was still doing my business. But like a lot of people, it was hard for me to go out and grow my business because nobody was doing business really, except for essential. And so 2020 put me back and, you know, I was grateful that I had some capacity and some demand for the skills and experiences I had to be able to piece things together. But, you know, I think in 21 into 22, it was really slim pickings. I had, you know, had, I don't know, four or five clients and I was doing good work. I was enjoying it. But it wasn't until really the middle of 2023 when things started to kind of percolate and get onto a consistent trajectory for me. So I had a gap of 2020, 2021, 2022, and half of 2023 where I was just sort of flailing and floundering and struggling to find my traction. I was looking back at it, I feel like I was trying to sort of take what I was trying to accomplish and fit it into what the paradigm was that others had. And I think I had a long, we went to visit my daughter in Italy for 2 weeks. She was studying abroad and gave me some time to think and reflect. And I think the punchline for me, Sam, was I'm like, I talk about thriving authentically and living authentically and being true to your values. And I'm not doing any of that. Like I'm not doing it intentionally, but I'm sort of being sucked into the vortex of what the paradigm is. And I think that's the downside to a protected sort of 23-year corporate career and all the perks that come with it is that you don't have to. You might, but you don't have to sort of like put your stake in the ground. You can sort of coast for a little while and you don't miss too much because once you kind of catch back up, you get your breath, you just get back on the trajectory you're on. You can't do that as an entrepreneur. You've got to be going all the time and be bringing your best at every moment. So I think I needed that little bit of a, I don't know what you want to call it, but like a cruise control or floundering or stall or sputtering period of time to really get good with what I really, really wanted to do and how I wanted to serve more powerfully. And coming back from Italy in the middle of 2023, like I did, it just started to take off. And nothing really changed, I think, except my approach and my mindset. My gratitude, you know, my priority. It was really more about how can I serve more powerfully and less about how can I get more clients or how can I fill my calendar or how can I increase my revenue. It was really just about if I'm the right fit, then it'll happen. If I'm not, it won't. And I'll just move on to the next opportunity for the right fit. So it became a matter of like, take as many shots as you can, because you might need to take 100 to get 10 goals. versus taking 20 shots thinking you're going to get 10 goals just because maybe once before in your life you could do that. But it was all very experiential and organic, and it sort of happened like it had to happen for me to come to that conclusion. And you're never really done. You don't figure it out or have it all solved, but that's tops in my mind every day now, that when I meet with an interested CEO or a business owner who is saying the things that I hear that maybe I can help them, I'm much more interested in being sure that I can serve them more powerfully before anything else. And if I can't, I'll put them in touch with someone that can, or I'll tell them that I'm probably not the right person for them, you know? So you need to fall back a little bit, I think, or slip and fall. I mean, I've got stories, I'm sure like you do, of friends who are entrepreneurs that slept in their car and they ate ramen noodles and whatever. I fortunately never had to experience that. But on the same token, I had my version of, oh shit, is this going to work? Should I go back and get a job? You know, is this the right thing? Am I really an entrepreneur, or am I just pretending to be one? You know? So I don't think I really felt like an entrepreneur until the last couple of years, to be perfectly honest.
So tell me about, no, I completely understand. Can you tell me about what, kind of give me a moment during the floundering where it was peak, should I go back to a job? Like there's just, I don't know, maybe there's three different things you're being faced with, or what is that? How did that manifest?
Yeah.
And not only in your head, but in the environment around you.
Yeah, that's
and
a
what
great
had
question.
You decide to go back to it the next day?
Yeah. You know, that's a great question, because I haven't thought about it much from the perspective of the way I was feeling in the moment. I'm thinking about it. I'm a big fan of Dan Sullivan and Benjamin Hardy's work and The Gap and the Gain. So I'm thinking a lot more of it today as a gain from where I was to where I am. But at the moment, I was in the gap, if you will, you know, and in the moment with you today, I'm thinking of how I was feeling at that time. And I think I kept thinking, I mean, I wasn't thinking of it this way, but looking back on it, I was thinking of it this way. I had this really cool set of products, services that I was providing, tools, frameworks, whatever. And damn it, they're cool to me and they ought to be cool to you, Sam. So I don't know why you don't see why these are so cool. And what's wrong with you that you don't see these are as cool as I think they are? No, I didn't say those things. But in the moment, I felt sort of like, why do I have this better mousetrap and nobody has mice? You know, it felt really, really awful to feel like you had this great thing that was going to change the world for these business owners, but nobody seemed interested. So at the time, I just felt like sort of I had, what's the phrase? When you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yep.
You know, I felt more like a nail looking for a hammer, you know? And so it was just, that was one thing that was going on during the floundering was, in retrospect, I think I was focused way too much on the solution I had than the problem I was solving. So I think that's a really good lesson for me that serves me today is it's not about the solution. It never is. It's about the problem. And if you can be the person that gets rid of the problem for someone, I'm sure it's the same in your business, then the solution becomes secondary. Nobody really cares how the watch is made. They just want to know what time it is, you know? So that was one kind of thing that was happening at the time. I think the second thing was my opportunity to do healthcare, sales and marketing, account management related things was still there. So I was always able to sort of have some cash flow, and it was easier for me to sort of like make a mistake and not feel like I was under the gun. So there's times I wish that I was sleeping in my car eating ramen noodles, because it might've changed my perspective faster and with less, you know, frustration.
Sure.
Because I always felt like I had sort of this sort of quasi safety net. I knew I didn't want to go back to Merck or go back, you know, into the world I was in, but at the same time, having the ability to sort of make ends meet in ways other than the way I was forging. And that was the second thing. So I think, you know, the whole concept of burn the boat wasn't fully a thing for me. And then I think the third thing that I'm still learning is getting really good about knowing yourself. Like, what's the phrase? People buy from people they like, or some version of that, right?
Yeah.
So if you're going to sell your services or your products or what the value you create in the world, I think it starts by recognizing that you're selling yourself. And even if you're showing up eager and energized and willing to help, if there's a small smidge of you don't believe it, no one's going to believe it. So I learned in the moment that, like, while I wasn't really sure that I was cut out for this entrepreneurial endeavor, I knew I was a good facilitator and coach and trainer and teacher of things. But at that time, I had it in reverse. I think I needed to be a better entrepreneur first to serve entrepreneurs better. And then the rest comes along with the ride. So had I to do it over again, those are the three things I do differently. I would focus more on the solution. I mean, sorry, the problem I'm solving than the solution I'm offering. I would burn the boat faster and more completely, and I would be really, really good at being confident with who I am and what I believe, and less about what I do.
So the saying "burn the boat," I've heard the saying before, but I'm struggling with it right now. Isn't it like burn the boat, learn to swim, something like that? How's that
Yeah,
work?
I've never heard of it that way, but that makes sense.
I'm trying to think of what the full saying is. I'm gonna have to Google it if you don't
I've
know
only
it.
heard it burn the boat, and I think the image I've seen in the context is, you have this boat and the water drifting away from the dock, and you've got one foot on the dock and one foot on the boat, and sooner or later your legs go like that, and you got to make a decision: jump on the boat or get on the dock. But you got to burn the boat. So I look at it a little differently from my own experience, Sam, and I think it's Confucius said, "He who chases two rabbits catches neither."
Yes.
And that's probably more apropos for my situation because, I'm not a Star Wars fan, but I think it's Yoda that says, "Do or do not, but decide," or
There's
something
no
like that.
try.
There
There's
is
no
no try.
try.
So I think
Do
when it
or
comes
do
to
not, there's no
entrepreneurialism,
try.
you have to decide, like, this is what I'm going to be because. And I think that's true about anything. I don't think that's just entrepreneurialism, but I think there's something to be said for being authentic and in your skin. I like to say owning your vibe so that you can show up unabashedly who you are everywhere you go, even if it is chasing two rabbits. It's just know who you are and be good with it,
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. There's almost a portion of like burn the dock. You're on
Burn the
the
boat or burn
boat
the deck. Yeah, I don't care which one you burn,
and
but you can't be on both of
can't be
them.
on both of them. And you can't look back, it seems like, too. So that's fascinating. So what was it that really got you to come back then? Because you'd mentioned the gap, the lull. Did you just kind of need that hiatus and that was enough? Was it kind of a period of burnout, or what drives you to say, I'm doing it again today? Doing it again today.
I love that question. There's probably a lot of things, but I'm reflecting on where I was in that moment, probably the most vulnerable period in that couple of year window. What kind of reinvigorated me to kind of go full on was the trust I'd built with my clients felt really important. Like it felt like energy. It felt like a heartbeat, like a reason, So maybe it's pride, maybe it's ego, maybe it's obligation, duty, honor, privilege, any of those synonymous words. But what I would really say is that there were three or four clients I had at the time that were like, "You've transformed our team. Our business is better because you're involved with it," or whatever. And that was affirmation that I'm doing the right thing. Why would I give up on that? Like, I'm having the effect I want to have. So if I stop because I don't have a tool that I can figure out how to make work, or I can't get people to want the tool, then I'm giving up, on what I think is the real value, which is helping leaders transform their teams and create more value for the business, And so I go back to what I shared with you earlier, like working with those reps when I was a sales leader, watching them struggle, they wanted to do well, but they weren't because oftentimes they were just the right person in the wrong job. So I would have conversations with them that sounded like, what would it take to make you happy? And almost every time they would say, working where I used to work, or going off and starting a coffee shop with my brother-in-law. Well, then why aren't you doing that? Well, because I make a lot of money here and it's an easy job and no one's firing me. And I'm like, well, would you like me to fire you? And like, no. And I said, well, then what would make you happy? This, when? 3 months. Take 3 months and figure it out. And then if you're still here, we'll have a different conversation. So it's giving people the license to sort of be free to choose their destiny and own their shit in a way that makes them make decisions they might not make otherwise. And that advice is advice I needed to have for myself. And I think the trust my clients at the time put in me and the words they gave me were the fuel and the corroboration of why I chose to do this work in the first place. And that's still today important to me because, I'm often faced with situations where I know for one reason or another, continuing my work with a client may not be the best for them. It's good for me, but not for them. And I feel super confident saying to them, should we be doing this? Like, you don't seem to be doing the work. You don't seem to have the time, the desire. You haven't paid the invoice in a couple months. What's going on? No, we want to keep working with you. It's just A, B, and C. And I'm like, well, if you're committed, I'm committed. If you're not, let's just stop because there's no benefit to either one of us. And in the times that I've done that, it's been interesting to hear how the person on the other side of the Zoom call or the table will say, really? Like, you don't want to just take my money? And I'm like, no, I want to help you do the things that the people who believed in me when I was struggling said they got from me. I want that for you too. And if we can't get it, then there's no reason to do it,
Right. No, you're exactly right. And that's really, that's fascinating to me because it's, going back to what you said, people buy from people they like. I heard it said differently here recently, and I completely agree. And it kind of feeds into what you've been saying essentially is I think people buy from people they trust.
Yeah, that's
And
probably
it,
a more accurate way to put it. Yeah.
and I, yeah. And I think it's exactly what you said. And what's interesting to me is, so part of my journey the last couple of years has been trying to be a better salesman, only to just realize that, just essentially it's similar sort of journey, it sounds like for you. It's like, well,
Yeah.
being a better salesman sometimes is just showing up, solving the problem, and
Yeah.
creating an environment where people trust that you can do it. And to your point, if
Yeah.
you're not believable, if you don't believe it yourself, then
Nobody
nobody's
else
gonna
will.
trust you, right?
I had it shared with me in a way that sticks with me to this day. And I believe it was Dan Sullivan that said, think like a buyer. When you're selling, think like a buyer. Don't think like a seller. And having spent my career in sales leadership, albeit pharmaceuticals, which is different than selling what you and I do, I think it obeys the tenets of trust, which if you're thinking like a buyer, you're putting the person you're selling to and their priorities and needs way ahead of yours. And if that's the mindset you take into an engagement with someone you're trying to convince that you can help, you're gonna have a much different outcome.
Yeah.
Thinking like a buyer.
Yeah, 100%. So what are some of the things that smaller businesses can do? So typically, when are you engaging with people? What's kind of the size where things kind of start to stall a little bit that bring that
Yeah.
about? Or are people engaging with you at every size?
Yeah, I'm learning more and more that with what I do, the size of the organization is less relevant. I wouldn't say it's irrelevant, but I just started with a client in California that has four people in the entire company. And the work I do looks exactly the same as another client that I have that has 60 people and another one that has 100 people. So I do the same exact thing for all three companies, 4, 60, and 100. And all that changes is the top line revenue, the profit margin, and the number of bodies on the payroll. But what doesn't change is the challenges that they face and the need to have some relative structure and order and process to manage those challenges. And so while the way I might help each of those three companies looks a little different because the capacity, the scope might be different. The issues are the same. Now, having said that, I think that every organization, irrespective of size, has a season. So if you're a real startup company and you're kind of bootstrapping and you're trying to create something from your garage, there may not be enough awareness of the challenges and frustrations yet to where I could help. And then conversely, on the other end, though I have done some work with departments inside large organizations like pharmaceutical companies, I worked with a couple of them. You know, if you get big enough to where you have like a chief people officer or chief learning and development officer, a whole learning and development organization, or a big HR function, you know, I'm probably not going to be able to give you a lot of extra value because you already have the infrastructure for that. So I like to say somewhere between 2 million and 250 million in revenue, somewhere between 10, although I have as low as 4, 10 people and 250 people is a, maybe 150 people is a pretty normal size organization. But I have a prospect I'm working with right now that has 190. I just started with a company that has 4. And I have a couple clients with 9 and 10 and 15 and 30 and 75 and 90. So that's really, I think it's more about the season in your business that you're in. And you've probably reached a level of tenure where what you're doing, you've been doing it long enough to have an idea of what your kind of revenue projections are and what your margins are up and down, how the market's performing around you, the people you need, should you grow, should you expand, you know, and then you're just faced with these challenges. Well, are we ready to do that? Are we suited to do that? This company that I just started with 4 people knew enough about the kind of work I did from talking to other people that he reached out to me through Entrepreneurs Organization where I met him and said, I'd like to know what it's like to work with you because I want to grow my company to X number of people in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years. And I'm not ready to do that. I don't have the infrastructure to sustain it. If someone came in from the outside into my organization, they wouldn't know how we do things around here. So I need to create an identity of how we operate. So that's kind of what I do is shape that organizational identity and really 9 different ways. But ultimately, it doesn't matter if you're 4 person or 250 person, you still have identity. We all do. You know, that's what makes us.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I've met a few folks through Entrepreneurs Organization as well. It's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
It
group,
is a great group.
It seems like.
Yeah.
That's cool. So, what are some of the things then that can kind of line people up for success prior to engaging you? So that was kind of the basis for the question. So you mentioned 4
yeah.
people. Let's assume somebody's just starting out, or maybe they're 2 or 3 people at this point. What are some of the kind of the foundational blocks that they can start to have in a place to where maybe things don't fall quite as awry as soon? And on
yeah.
the same token, they've got kind of a basis for a foundational sort of like, hey, Bill, I you know, I heard this podcast. I got some of these things in place beforehand, but now we're here and we need to hit that next level.
Yeah, that's a great question. I appreciate you asking it because, you know, again, I don't think it matters as much the size of your organization or even where you are in your season, because I think it's always the same answer. You know, I think you need to be vulnerable. And what that looks like is be willing to learn, open-minded, humble, not risk averse, but maybe not risky. But I think there's a level of vulnerability that, that needs to exist. Within the organization. And I'll use your example. If it's 2 or 3 people, there's got to be a willingness to say, you know what? In this 4-person organization, that was a hallmark element of this CEO in the first 5 minutes I met with him via Zoom. He was like, I could cut my own hair, but why would I do that? You know, I could change my own oil, but I don't have to. So I want to know what it's like for you to do it for me. So a vulnerability and an openness to say, I need and want help. That's the first thing. The second thing is I think a relative insight or introspection or identity of themselves, like they have to be able to be self-aware. Maybe they're not yet, but they have to be able and willing to be self-aware, inwardly sound, but also others focused, meaning they know who they are and they're eager and willing to learn, curious how the people around them are, if it's a partner or a small group of employees. Like caring of others and confident in self. That's the second thing I'd say. I like to call that insight. So vulnerability, insight, and the third is a belief in what they're doing. I don't care if you're going to come up with ice to sell to Eskimos. You believe you've got the best ice to sell to Eskimos ever invented. You have a belief in what you do that just oozes out of you. Now, it doesn't have to be super gregarious and outgoing, but you have to really believe what you're doing. Because if you don't, go back to my own experience, it can be hard to sell. And then finally, you have to have an energy that's real and genuine and powerful. Now, that doesn't mean Tony Robbins pounding the pulpit or jumping up and down like a crazy man or woman, but you have to have your own energy, quiet or not, that people want to be around. So I like to say the company vibe really is vulnerability, insight, belief, and energy. And any leader that has those four things is ready for what it takes to go to the next level. Because all the rest is just tools and training and teaching and learning and adaptation and implementation. But if you don't have those four things, you can give someone the perfect set of tools and they're probably not going to put them to the use they're intended.
I love it. So as we're starting to kind of get towards the end here, we have a fun question we like to ask. So at Lockbod, we have the motto, "If we've seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants." It's from
I like that.
Isaac Newton, who
Yeah.
said, "If I have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants."
Yeah.
And then it actually goes back further than that. But
Yeah.
who's been a giant in your life that's enabled you to see further?
Yeah, gosh, there's so many. That's I could name several. There's one that comes to mind right now, and his name is Preston True. I don't think you would know who that is, but he was an EOS implementer that I met when I was EOS is a business operating system I used to do. But early in my coaching career, I was kind of just going out of my self-made toolbox and my experiences, and I felt a strong need for structure and a framework and a process. And I happened to meet Preston through a mutual friend, and he invited me to join his practice for a year or so, and kind of he became a mentor to me, and I learned a ton from him. And I think a lot of who I am now as a coach and a guide and a leader existed before I met Preston, but Preston was one that I consider a giant because he's so good at what he does. And he's a coach here in the Metro Detroit area where I live. And it's very common in the circles in which we both run for me to run into somebody who knows Preston. And I'm grateful to not only know him, but to have learned under him and to be, kind of taught a lot of the things that you need to be successful in what we do from him. So Preston True is somebody that I would say is a giant in my world, that is probably less popular than, Ralph Waldo Emerson or, who can, and why can't I think of other names?
You're good. Hey, I mean,
Yeah.
that's,
Famous poets or authors or whatever, but Preston's the type of guy that when you meet him and people who know him will say that guy is awesome, and I'm really grateful to have learned from him. And I think,
That's
there's lots of
fascinating.
other more famous people like Benjamin Hardy, Simon Sinek, are people that I really value. But yeah.
That's good. That's good.
Now who's the author? Why can't I think of his name? It doesn't matter, but the famous author. Hemingway, Ernest Hemingway, that's who I was thinking of. So yeah.
So what are some ways people can get a hold of you or connect with you
Yeah.
or connect with your program?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. Shiftin90.com is a new website that I've created that highlights the way I work with my clients and gives them an idea of the type of work that I do. So shiftin90.com. My email address is BG, Bill Green, BG, my initials, at meetbillgreen.com. That would be an easy way to reach me. And then, of course, LinkedIn. I don't know if you have show notes or something like that, but you can certainly click on my LinkedIn profile. That's a great way to find out. But there's really no way you can't reach me some form or another, either through shiftin90.com or my website, Meet Bill Green, and email me. So always happy to have a conversation and see how I can help.
Excellent. Thank you so much for
Yeah.
joining us today, Bill. Really a pleasure
Yes.
having you.
I enjoyed it, Sam. Thanks a lot. Great to know you.
Good to know you too. Bye, everybody.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.